Blog Talk Radio.
You got to listen to the Bob Carson Show. It's about the real deal. And this is Les Leopold, the author of Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I've the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009, when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
Hi, this is Harry Kaysen, member supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on, not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
This is Greg Palin, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book, Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. And you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
And welcome to Carson's Corner with the Election Boycott Advocates. This is your co-host, Chris Driscoll. And along with me so far tonight is our good buddy from the West Coast, Rainer Shea. Looks like Bob's a little late coming to the party. How you doing, Rainer?
Oh, this is a relaxing time between Christmas and New Year. It's a time
right.
of introspection, and for many of us, it's a time when we look at the last decade and think about what's going to happen in the year and decade ahead, and that's apparently the theme of this show.
Definitely, and I know you've been thinking about that. So have I. Doing my research. I don't know if you got a chance to look at it because I sent it to you kind of late, but I just finished reading Michael Roberts' blog, end of year blog, where he gives his forecast for the coming year and years to follow. So I think I'd like to start the show with talking about prognostications or forecasts, you might call it, for the economy coming up. People who've listened to me know that for the last 3 years, I've been predicting the onslaught of a new global recession, new global meltdown, downturn, whatever you want to call it. They keep coming up with new names because the old ones don't sit well with people anymore. It used to be called a depression, but they don't use that term anymore because most of the people you see on television, radio, and in the political world are weasels, and they're paid by the capitalist ruling class to fool us and to make us think that it's not quite so bad as all of us seem to think it is. In any case, that oncoming global downturn has still not hit us, and I was real happy to see that Michael Roberts is my favorite Marxist economist, bar none by far, and I read his stuff religiously. Every year at the end of the year, he does this forecast, and I pretty much go by it, and I think that it's really, really an important forecast, so I'll get into that. But before I do, I just want to give you a chance, Rainer. You have any thoughts on the global economy, the nation's economy in the coming period?
My big question is I wonder when the economy is going to next crash. Is it going to happen sometime in 2020 or 2021? I read the predictions from economists, and one perception is that there's around a 50% chance that the crash will happen in 2020. I've seen estimations that put it at like half that is likely, and I'm thinking of the estimates that put the recession possibility pretty low, that make it seem safe. Those estimates are including the methodologies that make it the situation seem better than it actually is.
Yeah. Well, they definitely have a lot of that going on.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you think it? Oh.
Well, go ahead. Go ahead.
My point is, would you say it'll happen in the next year, like by 2021?
I'm pretty well convinced that it will. However, take that with a caveat, and the caveat is that I've been wrong the last 3 years. Although there has been, you know, a big slowdown, big slump, and I'll get into that here. But, yeah, I am definitely still convinced that it's coming, that it's going to be bad, that it'll be the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression of the 1930s. And there will be certainly a lot of big repercussions from that. But, you know, you've got to ask, why was I wrong in the last 3 years? What was going on? Well, here's the thing. When you look at the fundamentals from a Marxist analysis, all the fundamentals lead you to the conclusion that a big global slump is on the way. And you know what? That hasn't changed. It was that way in 2016, at the end of 2016, end of 2017, end of 2018. And here we are at the end of 2019, and yes, it's still that way. So what's different? I mean, what caused the capitalist, the global capitalist system, the imperialist system, to be able to avoid that slump for lo these many years? Basically, the years of Donald Trump as the, you know, capitalist class's chosen global leader, although a lot of capitalists don't really like him very much. Especially if you look in the billionaire class, they're not real happy with Trump. But Trump has done some things that did make them happy, like give away $1 trillion, mostly to the rich. That made them real happy. And that's something that forestalled a slump in the economy. Something else that has forestalled a slump in the economy is quantitative easing. Quantitative easing around the world has skyrocketed in the last 3 years, especially in the last year, as central banks decided that they need to rain money down on the capitalist class. Interest rates have been approaching 0%. So, I mean, how much better of a deal on loans can you get than 0% or close to 0%? The this raining down of helicopter money, as it's called, quantitative easing, which is the technical term, which basically means that central banks all over the world create a lot of new money out of nothing, which ultimately has to lead to increased inflation. And then they lend that money out to big banks, and the big banks in turn lend it out to billionaires and their corporations. Now, what are the corporations doing with this? You'd think, wow, this is like almost like free money. And you would think, wow, I would go out there and invest in new capital hardware and new buildings and new technologies to make my businesses more efficient. But no, that is not what they have been doing. What they have been doing is using practically all that helicopter money that's descended down upon them to in stock buybacks, bond buybacks. They buy back stocks to try to artificially pump up the value of their stocks. And lo and behold, over the last year especially, we've seen an enormous increase in the value of stocks. We've seen the stock market go up and up and up with a few hiccups here and there, but it keeps going up. So that, first of all, you know, that's like a huge injection of money into the economy that has caused the economy has caused the entire capitalist class to avoid a big recession. Another aspect of this is because these capitalists are not investing in new technologies, the rate of worker productivity has really slowed down, tremendously slowed down. And because of that, has decreased capitalist profits. Profits are the profit rate, that is way down in the last couple of years. Also, what the capitalists have had to do, because they haven't invested in new technology, is that they've had to suck up all of the unemployed, so as Marx called them, the army of the unemployed, I guess, that they have had to hire lots of new people to make up for the fact that they're not, that they're, that worker productivity isn't going up. What that has ended up doing is causing the global unemployment rate to be the lowest it's been in more than four decades. The global unemployment rate now is at 5%. I mean, that's pretty incredible when you think of it. And in the United States, it's even a bit lower than that. What that means is, even though more than 40% of American workers live just slightly above the poverty rate, even though they're working, they at least they've got some income coming in, as opposed to where they would be if a downturn struck. So all these factors have been countervailing factors that have stalled, let's say, that have stalled the oncoming crisis. However, you know, you can't keep doing that forever. I mean, basically, the economy, the whole global economy today, is not based on production as a healthy economy would be. It's based on basically on fictions, fictitious money, fictitious unemployment that is very shallow. Shallow because workers are taking home less than they have in several decades, and so what you see though is that take for instance borrowing. Borrowing worldwide is at the highest rate practically ever. I mean, global debt right now stands at $250 trillion. I've talked before about the outstanding derivatives, where the derivatives are something like $570 trillion, which is much more than the whole entire world GDP. So, in other words, more than the world produces in a year. All of these factors, though, super high debt rate, super high derivatives, outstanding derivatives, the fact that these people are not really producing more, the economy is just not growing as far as real production of commodities, which is really the basis of a healthy economy, and an economy that isn't growing in its commodity production is headed for big trouble. So because of all that, I really believe we're headed for serious problems in the economy in the coming year. Hopefully this will hit the fan while the American elections are going on, so definitely affect there. And that will affect just in general the attitude of the global working class. And we're already seeing big changes in that, as we spoke about last week. Global protests and strikes against neoliberalism and imperialism way up just in the last year, and my prediction is that these protests and strikes will continue. They'll grow in magnitude, and they'll grow in number over the coming year as well. So, Rainer, what are your thoughts?
Oh, behind that explain how exactly the global economy is teetering on the edge of recession and why exactly that hasn't happened yet. And as you've explained, this reality that the supposed economic boom of the last decade has been based on bubble, the capitalist ideologues or partisan ideologues have still tried to spin narratives in recent years about this boom being a special thing that's the result of unfettered capitalism, like this book, The Trump Boom, America's Soaring Economy and the Left Plot to Stop It, Andrew F. Puzder, this pro-Trump author. So narratives like that aren't based in reality, and they're going to come crashing down likely in the next year. And what you said about the potential for these mass protests to continue to proliferate and grow, that encourages me so much. I mean, how are these governments going to deal with it? These protests have been happening in most places seemingly mainly in the last half year, unless I've only caught the tail end of them. Throughout Chile, Ecuador, Haiti, Iraq, and many other third world countries, as well as some first world countries like France, poor and working people have been rising up. And so far, the capitalist governments in these countries have been able to forestall a revolution through brute force and by doubling down or by giving concessions, like it has happened in Ecuador. But if this continues, as you say, and if this continues to grow in reaction to a larger crisis, then the coming decades might see the fall of several capitalist governments, because something like that has already happened in the last year in Sudan, as mass strikes have overthrown the Sudan's longtime CIA-backed dictator, and now in Sudan, communist entities have been able to try to gain more of a foothold. So, do you think that's the kind of thing we'll see repeated in the following decade? Could governments like Chile and Haiti and Iraq be overthrown?
Yes, that's the uprisings like this. We know throughout history, when we see periods of uprisings developing around the world, in many cases revolutionary overthrows of the capitalist regimes and rise of workers' regimes, is one of the likely outcomes. And we'll be talking about that more, I think, a little bit later, especially under the topic, Will a New Revolutionary Marxist Movement Arise? I see this decade as a decade of the rise of the global working class, or the global working class has been beaten down, repressed, oppressed tremendously for the last four decades, what we might call the neoliberal era. And I definitely see neoliberalism coming under attack now from various sources, that's going to be one of the many great crises the global capitalist class capitalist ruling class is forced to reckon with. And, you know, have no doubt also that these evil forces, these capitalist forces, are ready for us. You know, while we've been being beaten down and our organizations destroyed to the point where we have no, you know, serious organizations to stand up to these attacks, while that's all been going on, the capitalist ruling class, they know that this is coming. They're getting ready for it. They have been getting ready for it. You know, like in the United States, where they have giant concentration camps built over the last decade that they claim are for that they claim are either for keeping immigrants in or for keeping people sheltered during national emergencies. Some of these are come under the charge of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. But in fact, these will make the perfect concentration camps for when the working class really starts rising. And this is going to happen. Hopefully the working class becomes smart enough to realize that, number one, we need to become armed. Of course, a lot of the working class is already armed. But secondly, we need to become organized. Thirdly, we need a revolutionary Marxist movement, a Leninist political party that is capable of really leading. That's something I wanted to talk about in a little bit. But, you know, those are all necessary for the working class to turn these unorganized uprisings that will inevitably happen and that are inevitably already happening in a much bigger way just over the last year. We need to be able to turn that into a revolutionary force. And without the education, organization that only a Leninist political party can provide, that's not going to happen. So that's some of the problems that we will face, I believe, in the coming decade. So,
yeah,
any
can,
more? Go ahead.
I can imagine the kinds of narratives that will appear in this scenario of crisis. Who's President Trump going to blame? He's going to blame China. He's going to blame foreign countries like China for the economy's collapse. More dangerously, they're going to blame the poor and the marginalized.
Definitely.
You see how the Trump administration is trying to arrest more homeless people and cut social services and put people in camps, including some American citizens. It's the process of state violence and structural violence that the capitalists are going to try to take advantage of, like they have as a rule since the inception of neoliberalism in the shock doctrine.
Yeah. The shock doctrine and the chaos doctrine, I'd say. Spreading chaos, spreading shock and awe, as the idiot George Bush called it. Definitely. Okay. Anything? Any other thoughts just on the economic forecast for the coming year and for the coming decade?
Well, we should realize that it's even bigger than the alarming financial instruments that you've described so far. It's also an issue of climate change, and which in the long term the biggest economic factor that's going to shape the 21st century.
Definitely.
We're going to, in the coming years, we're going to see great damage to infrastructure and to productivity and to commerce and to agriculture, all of the components of the economy and society as the climate collapse continues. And also another big factor in this coming depression is the collapse of the dollar. I got this idea from a Chris Hedges article that Chris Hedges wrote sometime this year about how the dollar is declining, and that's going to create a depression disaster. Will you agree with that?
Yeah.
Chris Hedges.
Absolutely, I agree with it. I mean, the dollar isn't declining. That's not the problem. The influence of the dollar, the power of the dollar throughout the world as the reserve currency, as the international reserve currency, has been collapsing. You know, a big part of that is that the imperialists, in their fights against countries they don't like, they've used sanctions as a weapon. Sanctions have become weaponized. And because of that, big, powerful countries like China, Russia, Iran, to name just a few, are seeking alternatives, and they're building alternatives. They have alternatives. For instance, the SWIFT system, which is used to make currency transfers around the world, another mechanism, fiscal mechanism that is controlled by the American American capitalist working class. I'm sorry, the American capitalist ruling class. The SWIFT system is being abandoned by Russia, being abandoned by China. Imagine that, China, the second most powerful economy on the planet, is abandoning this system. The dollar, big part of the reason that that American imperialism has been able to finance its military arm is that they use the power of the fact that their currency, the dollar, has since World War II dominated the global economy, and that is coming to an end. Chris is absolutely right. So when we say the decline of the dollar, we're not talking about the dollar's worth less now than it was last week. That kind of decline, the dollar value decline. What we're talking about is the global influence of the dollar. And the global influence of the dollar over the last several years has been shrinking, despite the tenacious tooth and nail fight by the imperialists to protect the dollar. And part of it's their own fault because they use these sanctions. Sanctions mean that people can't do business. And you look at, for instance, Nord Star. North Star 1, the pipeline being built between Russia and Europe, the Americans in the last month have sabotaged it by using their influence, issuing new sanctions, which have caused many businesses in Europe to stop working on the Nord Stream pipeline, and that's causing the pipeline right at its end because it's within a month, really, of being finished. And so in this last-ditch sabotage effort, they've sabotaged it by forcing many of the companies that were essential in completing the last part of the pipeline to stop working on a pipeline. So the fact that Russia and China are now designing other financial mechanisms that will allow companies to ignore American sanctions, to ignore American fiscal mechanisms like SWIFT, like the SWIFT system, and still do business, still trade, you know, still get paid at the end of the day when they finish their jobs, that, you know, is quickly, we're quickly coming to the point where that the American imperialists are no longer going to be able to do that kind of economic sabotage that they've just done against Russia. I have no doubt whatsoever that Russia will complete the pipeline, both pipelines, because there's another one going from Russia into Turkey that they're also attempting, that the imperialists are also attempting to sabotage. That I have no doubt that those pipelines will be finished, will be completed, but there's been this hiccup, this hurdle now that they're going to have to overcome. They'll have to find new companies that will be able to do what the old companies were doing and that the old companies refused to do. So, yeah, definitely Chris is onto something. I mean, it's something we've spoken about on this show over the last couple of years, the decline of the influence of the dollar. Many countries around the world. For instance, I mentioned the SWIFT system. European countries are now in the process of creating an alternative to SWIFT so that they can do business with countries like China and Russia. And they're most interested in doing business with China. So that they can do business with those countries while still going around the American-controlled SWIFT system. So it's going to take time to build these new financial mechanisms, global financial mechanisms, but it's happening. And people, even countries in Europe, which are supposedly American allies, are starting to realize that they're losing. I mean, because of America's sanctions against Russia, Europe has been a much bigger loser than Russia has because of the business Europe has lost in this process. And believe me, many of those countries are not happy with the situation.
Oh, this reminds me of a point made in Joseph Stalin's work, The Foundations of Leninism, where he mentioned what he judged to be the three main contradictions of capitalism, specifically capitalism in the imperialist age. These contradictions are the contradiction between the experience of the average proletarian member and the promises of capitalist prosperity. And there's also the contradiction between the desire of the imperialist nations to conquer territory and the desire from the conquered people for self-determination. There's also the contradiction between the capitalism desire for stability and the competition between different capitalistic countries and entities. I paraphrase all of those things Stalin mentioned, but I think you get the point about them. And the contradiction that we're talking about right now, you've just been talking about this contradiction where these different corporations and countries compete, and this creates friction within the global capitalist system, where certain imperialist countries lose out, and what we're seeing right now is not really the fall of Western imperialism and the rise of another kind of imperialism, but rather the fall of Western imperialism and the rise of a new multipolar order where China is the dominant player, but where thanks to China's benevolent global leadership, a new global imperialist hegemon isn't emerging, despite China's leveraging of capitalist markets. China isn't an imperialist power. It doesn't use loans and military power in a way that can be called imperialist, despite the efforts to characterize them as such.
Yeah.
As American companies compete with Chinese and Russian companies, we're seeing these contradictions play out.
Absolutely. So, and that really brings us around to topic number three, multipolarism and the rise of China and Russia on the world stage. There are other countries that should be included in that too, but China and Russia are the primary ones. China, more because of its gigantic economy. Russia, because of its military might and its ability to act as a counterbalance to American imperialism. While Russia is a capitalist country, Russia has tried for a long time to join the club, you know, of imperialist nations. And the Americans always rejected that. A lot of people wonder why. They think, well, Russia would be a perfect, partner and ally to the United States now that it's a capitalist country. However, the Americans really fear Russia coming back as the kind of power that it once was when it was part of the Soviet Union. And they really fear that, and they fear that in the long run that could damage the capitalist advantage in the United States. That's really why they're doing that. So they've pushed Russia into the position of being an enemy, even though Russia tried to be a friend. Finally, you know, somewhere along the line, President Putin kind of figured out, hey, these people, I can keep calling these people partner all I want, but they're not going to act like partners. They're going to act like enemies. So, the thing, too, is that China, governed by the largest political party in the world by the largest communist party in the history of the world. In the long run, we can be hopeful that China will start using that tremendous asset that it has, the fact that it is governed by this great communist party, to start influencing politics around the world, political influencing and instigating the rise of political movements. That takes us into topic four, will a new revolutionary Marxist movement arise? And I think that's one way that could happen, although, you know, China throughout its entire history has been isolationist. I mean, since 1978, China has opened up its economy. It's not economically isolationist, but it's still politically isolationist. China for a long time has not acted in the way the Soviet Communist Party did, in solidarity with the working class around the world and in solidarity with the liberation movements around the world. And one hopes that in the future, as China gains in economic power, that the Chinese Communist Party will start to bring back what it once had as a Leninist party, that is, its internationalist solidarity with the rest of the global working class, which would be a great help to the global working class, just as the Soviet Communist Party was a great help to the working class around the world during its time up until 1991.
Well, what would that look like? Like for China to try to directly aid revolutionary movements around the world, or to try to intervene in a situation like Bolivia?
Well, of course, the Soviet Union did all those things, all of what you just mentioned. The Soviet Union was a great friend to working class parties around the world. The Soviet Union was, in many cases, helped with financially, like, for instance, China. You know, China got a lot of money from the Soviet Communist Party, during the entire 1930s and then through up until its liberation in 1949. And that was crucial in helping the Chinese Party become the massive party that it became. Along the way, as the Chinese Communist Party and the parts of China that were ruled by the Chinese Communist Party in the 1930s, as they ended up going to war with the Chinese nationalists, you know, the Soviet Union also helped quite a lot with military aid, which was also crucial. So, yeah, I mean, to me, that's what an internationalist political party should be doing. For the time being, China is focused on rising itself up to where it is a world-class country that can stand up to any country in the world, including the imperialist United States of America. There's a good argument to be made that that's the appropriate thing for China to do right now. But things are going to change in the coming period as China emerges as the dominant economy in the world. And, I'm just saying, I hope that China will live up to its responsibility. The Chinese Communist Party, Communist Party of China, will live up to its responsibilities to provide solidarity through internationalism. We'll see. You know, that's something that the world lost when the Soviet Union collapsed.
No.
So.
Well, there's the other aspect, which is that China is moving the world towards that point, but through more passive means, as in hoping to get its model emulated throughout the third world.
Yeah.
And that's what the third world movement can do. And as for us in the first world, well, we've got our own host of obstacles that need to be overcome. I look at the history of the last 100 years, and I see how none of the Australia, New Zealand, the United States, all of the more Western European powers haven't undergone any communist revolution, and Russia has really been the exception among imperialist powers that have undergone that kind of shift. And,
yeah, not the only exception. I mean, East Germany, half of Germany, in other words, went through a communist revolution in the aftermath of World War II. And East Germany was among the most advanced economies on the face of the earth. There are other examples in Eastern Europe. But primarily, Russia was the first, and in many ways, the primary in that regard.
Yeah. So what it will take for the revolution of that kind to happen in the United States or France or the other countries of this type is.
Yeah.
I feel like first the third world needs to fall.
Yeah, well, I think that what we're looking towards is a global revolution. I think the era where we're just hoping for one revolution after another, like in the 70s and 60s, that's what we focused on, one individual revolution after another in the third world that seemed as though it was propelling us forward. And as I mentioned before, much to the credit of the Soviet Union, which helped in that process, helped working classes in those countries be able to do that. I think the time of global revolution is upon us in our future, in the coming decade. I don't know. You know, I'm old enough, Rainer, that by the end of this decade, I might not even be alive. We'll have to rely on guys like you who are still coming up. That's what I see possibly happening in the coming decade. Finally, before we, run out of time, we've got about 6.5 minutes left, will a new revolutionary Marxist movement arise? I put that as the last question. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, you've been in the thick of things, helping to organize political parties. Is this something that could happen in the United States of America, or, in other parts of the world, do we see it happening?
We're seeing it develop towards that in France, as the great masses of people have risen up for a sustained amount of time in the last year or so, and recently the people who specifically advocate for proletarian revolution have gained a voice throughout recent mass strikes. And so we're going to see the France continue to develop it, and the I think that a year from now, it's quite possible that the communists will have gained more of a presence in France, especially as the crisis Trump continued unrest. there's an inevitable progression of interest in socialism and revolutionary consciousness as a revolutionary crisis develops. And despite the presence of the reactionary forces, the interest in socialism and Marxism is going to continue to increase. And there are many obstacles that need to be overcome, such as co-optation by bourgeois ideology and the sheer lack of organizational power throughout the Western world. So we're going to need to engage in that educational work and build these organizations. But ultimately, as we go about our work, we need to get trained for militancy, showing up in mass protests, for occupying spaces, for defending our territories from the bourgeoisie with arms if necessary. And these are the kinds of things we need to get engaged with if we're going to win.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And that's what it takes. That's what it will take. People already having the consciousness need to help spread it. And in my opinion, that should be targeted. We've seen in the United States of America the biggest upsurge in popularity of socialism in the history of the country. I've watched the statistics for decades. The statistics have never been so high. A recent Gallup poll showed that more than 40% of adult Americans lean towards socialism as opposed to capitalism. Now, there's a big problem with what kind of socialism, you know? I mean, because basically, as usually happens, these people are first attracted to reformist socialism. And the problem with that is that reformist socialism is a dead end. We've seen that over more than 100 years, over the last century. It's definitely a trap and a dead end for the working class. We need to be winning socialists, people, especially young people with socialist ideas, over to revolutionary socialism, over to revolutionary Marxism. That is the task of people like us who consider ourselves revolutionary Marxist-Leninists. That is really the task. We need to be armed with the arguments, armed with the proof, show the proof to people who are newly arrived at attraction to socialism, show them the proof that reformist socialism is a dead end. People like Bernie Sanders and AOC, and the only way forward is through revolutionary Marxist, Leninist socialism. So, anyway, with that, Rainer, we've got less than a minute left. I want to invite people to join us again next week, same time, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard. And in the meantime, you can check us out on Facebook at Election Boycott Advocates. Just put it into the search engine, Election Boycott Advocates, at the search engine of Facebook. Other than that, thank you so much, Rainer. It's been a gas, as always. And thank you to all our listeners.
Yeah.
Okay, so long, Rainer.
So long.